Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk with one of the most interesting men I know, and I don't know him well, but I'm looking forward to getting to know him better in the course of this full hour of conversation. His name is Dr. James A. Lindsay. He is, of all things, a mathematician by training, a PhD in the science, no less. He is a man who knows a thing or two about education, but he's also become, I think, one of the most clear-eyed and articulate, well, analysts, commentators on, pundits, if you will, about the nature of the challenge that we're facing in this country, from those enemies within and their foreign friends who are seeking to take us down in the interests of, the Marxist end state of chaos leading to a new world order that will not be much to our liking, I figure. Before we get to James, we're going to speak to you for just a moment about today's Gaffney Brief. And it has to do with one of those enemies, foreign, as well as some of the things that it's trying to do to us. That would be North Korea. We're hearing a lot lately from the North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-un, about war, his preparations for it, his intent to engage in it, his willingness to annihilate not just South Korea, but us, using presumably the growing nuclear arsenal and longer range ballistic missiles that he is now acquiring at the horrific cost to his people, a great many of whom don't have enough to eat, let alone to support this exorbitant, extravagant investment in offensive weaponry. Why this is so important is our theory that what we're facing in 2024 in particular is more of the kind of arson that we've seen Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, engage in the past 2 years, in different parts of the world. North Korea is an obvious candidate for torching on for the same general purpose, distracting us, depleting our resources, dissipating our energy, and otherwise clearing the way for Xi's own acts of aggression towards Taiwan and perhaps us and other friends and allies of ours in the Western Pacific and perhaps even beyond. We're going to be tracking all of that in the course of this very important new year, and we're very pleased to have you with us for that purpose. Before we get on to other subjects, though, we're going to take stock of what all this looks like from the perspective of a man, again, that I have come to admire greatly, James A. Lindsay. James, it's good to have you with us. Thank you so much for taking a full hour of your time to explore some of our mutual concerns and hopefully give us some guidance as to what do we do about them. Good to have you.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you, Frank.
We're going to talk about some of your books in the course of this hour. Let me just mention right out of the gate, one of the most important, certainly the newest, The Marxification of Education. And I want to explore with you what is being done to us through the educational system to promote Marxism. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about what Marxism is, what it looks like today in particular. I think some of us have come to conclude we're dealing with now a second or maybe even a third generation of communism. Talk us through how you view that, and if you would, help explain where socialism fits into it as perhaps a distinct, different thing, or perhaps just a means of obscuring the truth, which is it's an entry-level drug.
Yeah, sure. So I do have a rather heterodox take on Marxism. My belief is actually that Marxism is just full stop, that it is a religion that Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels obviously codified in the 1840s in a particular way. It's based off of older ideas that were taken from, you know, monastic thinking, that if we could all come together in the monastery and share all our resources, we could have a great commune. It was taken off of a model of what the people in the 19th century believed was going on in primitive tribes, how they would share all their resources. This is what Marx sometimes referred to as primitive communism. And it was built off of the apparatus, like you said, of socialism, which is an economic theory that the state should actually be gathering and distributing resources for a allegedly higher level of efficiency, which doesn't seem to match economic law, but that's the sales pitch anyway. And so what I believe that Marx was actually doing was answering fundamental questions about the world and what it means to be a human being in the world. We are our own creator. We are ultimately a creative species, that we are blocked out of our creative potential in knowing ourselves to be who we are as creative people by the fact of the division of labor. So there are certain people who have hoarded to themselves a special form of property called capital. They dictate the structure of society on a very comprehensive level. They lock other people out of their capacity to make not just things, but also to see themselves in the things that they make, and to make history, and to make themselves into a true human being. The true nature of human beings for Marx comes out of this social apparatus, is that human beings are intrinsically a social species. We are meant to be socialists. We are, in fact, spiritually socialist. But we've forgotten that because of the division of labor and the bourgeois values put forth by the people who benefit from the division of labor. So what we're actually seeing is a reconstruction of the Gnostic esoteric religious structure. There is a power, which the Gnostics anciently called the demiurge, but what Marx called the bourgeois class, that structures all of society, and it locks everybody into a kind of material slavery where they don't know who they truly are, but they can spiritually awaken. Marx called it class consciousness or socialist consciousness, and they can liberate themselves from the prison of being that they're placed in by the powers that be. So when we misunderstand Marxism merely as an economic theory, we miss the essence of what it really is.
Yeah. This is so fascinating because one of the tenets of communism that we endlessly hear about is that it's atheistic. And you're talking about the roots in spirituality of this, of at least the founder of the enterprise. Square that circle, if you would.
Yeah, that's actually easier to square than people think it is. It is atheistic in the sense of being opposed to the traditional gods or the monotheistic god of Judeo-Christian belief. It's certainly atheistic in that regard. But what it's actually doing is clearing the superstitious gods, as it would hold, out of the way to make way for its man-centered religion. Marx is very, very clear, if, for example, in the Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts he wrote in 1844, preceding the Manifesto by a few years, that atheism is actually just a precondition for communism. Communism is something far more. Communism is a set of beliefs. Atheism is merely an abstraction that clears the way for people to adopt a truly human-centered view of reality, which, as he wrote in his critique of Hegel's philosophy of right a year earlier, sets up man as his own true son to revolve around himself. And so it is a man-centered religion. In other words, when I say it's like a Gnostic religion, the old Gnostics believed that there was a dualistic spiritual realm and we're trapped in this material world by the evil demiurge demon character that calls himself Yahweh. But what happened in this is that's a very kind of pre-modern way of conceiving of the spiritual world. What was happening in the 17th and 18th centuries in Europe was that people started to think maybe the spiritual world is actually what Hegel referred to as the Geist of society. Maybe it's a social phenomenon. It's the spirit of how everybody works together. And so Marx relocated the true spiritual realm in the social realm. And so human sociality becomes the basis of the spiritual transcendent. And our goal is to remember that we were perfectly social beings. So you have to get the old gods out of the way. So that's the atheism part, but that's merely a beginning place. Then you can adopt communism.
We have to pause for just 1 second on that point, and we will return to it momentarily. Stay tuned for more with James Lindsay right after this. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. 3 years ago, America was fundamentally transformed, not by an insurrection, but by those who engineered a riot at the Capitol and what they've done to weaponize and exploit that event ever since. The few who engaged in actual crimes that day posed no credible threat of overthrowing the government of the United States, and many hundreds of patriotic American citizens peacefully demonstrating on the Hill have been prosecuted, jailed, bankrupted, and otherwise unconstitutionally subjected to cruel and unusual punishment, thanks in part to the suppression of exculpatory evidence of official decisions that facilitated their entry into the Capitol and provoked the crowd. At Valley Forge today, President Biden will continue his practice of vilifying not just them, but half the country, who were also disenfranchised and have subsequently been relentlessly portrayed as enemies of democracy and potential violent extremists. Really? This is Frank Affney. We're back with Dr. James Lindsay, a mathematician by training, but a man who has, I believe, a grasp on the order of things that is far beyond math or even science. It's a holistic approach that is extraordinarily edifying. And we've been talking a little bit about the roots of communism in Marx's vision of the social beings and how socialism was the natural order of things. And where we are going next is to understand how this has evolved in our time to communism 1.0, one might say, or 2, 3.0, I think perhaps at the moment. And James, I want you to sort of just further tease this out, if you would, the extent to which we are now witnessing in practice inside the United States, Marxism, unlike anything we've seen to this point.
Yeah, I think that your 1.0, 2.0, and that we're in 3.0 for communism is probably correct. It is probably the third true, you know, iteration of communist theory. And that's why I wanted to start out with this building block that it's actually a spiritual practice because, and in fact, being an esoteric spiritual practice, it's what we might call syncretistic or what Christians would call cafeteria Christianity, only it's cafeteria Marxism. In other words, that which works is that which they believe. In fact, Marx defines, the Marxists, I should say, define, they say that their definition of truth, if you go to the Marxist.org website, they actually have an encyclopedia. You look up the word truth and what they mean by truth. They say it's that which works to put theory in practice. And so you can very easily understand that it would evolve based on its circumstances. The original Marxist theory Marx laid out was this kind of spontaneous movement of history where capital would disenfranchise the worker. The worker would start to awaken to a consciousness of the class struggle. He would realize that if he bands together with his other workers, that he is a mover of history, and spontaneously a revolution would evolve. And the next thing you know, you would enter into socialism that could evolve at the end into a communism that no longer needs a state to manage it, because people would be perfectly reminded of their social nature and creative nature. Well, that didn't work. That worked nowhere. That never happened. But along comes Lenin in 1917, and he pushes the Bolshevik. And now we've entered into communism 2.0. This is not a spontaneous communism. This is a stagist communism. This is one where you need a vanguard that pulls the stupid proletariat along into the glorious revolution because they don't understand for themselves why they should become communists. And It literally is that a band of elites, in this case, the Bolsheviks, believe that they understood the theory better and they were going to force everybody into it. This relies on a doctrine from Marxism called the inversion of praxis, which is a kind of more contemporary and simpler word for that is socialization. That if the social structure is socialist, people will become socialist because they'll be socialized into socialism. That's the idea. And the schools become integral to that because children are the most impressionable and they don't know that there is an alternative if you start them very young. That also,
which of course a premium is placed upon doing.
Correct.
By this practice.
It turns out that communism 2.0 also didn't work. It faced a problem that the Marxists through the early part of the 20th century referred to as the problem of production. Namely, it can't produce anything. it causes mass famines. It causes not just the mass murders, but it just cannot arrange an economic system that can actually produce for its people. And this becomes a major problem that leads eventually to poverty and collapse. We see that in the Soviet Union. We see it again through the Eastern Bloc. We saw it even in South America and Cuba, and we saw it in CCP China under Mao. So a third generation had to evolve. And this kind of, there's two pieces to this story. One is that the Western Marxists, starting in the 20s and 30s, realized that Western civilization, capitalist countries, will not go Marxist. There's something preventing them. So they started to create a criticism in culture. They said, we have to actually infiltrate the culture institutions, the faith, the media, the education, religion, family, law. We have to get inside of those and start pushing communist values from within to get the culture to soften up for and adopt a consciousness that will be amenable to revolution. And that evolved into what we now refer to as woke eventually down the line of many years, almost 100 years of development, mostly in our universities. Right. But in
as essentially another term for cultural Marxism?
Yes, very much so. So cultural Marxism arose with George Lukács in Hungary and Antonio Gramsci in Italy. And then it went on to develop in the Frankfurt School in Germany, which was imported to the United States and integral in working with our OSS as a precursor to the CIA, infused into our elite university system, first at Columbia, then in the University of California system, and really pushed a critical Marxist view.
Pause there for a second. You introduced the CIA's involvement in the proliferation of the Frankfurt School in our academic institutions. Did I get that?
Well, it's possible that the CIA helped with that particular project, but what is not in doubt is that the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, that became the CIA during World War II, hired the Frankfurt School kind of kingpin. He wasn't the director, but he was a very influential, probably the most influential member, which is Herbert Marcuse, the most influential neo-Marxist in the 1960s and 70s for certain, until he died in late 78 is when he died. But during World War II, they brought him in to explain German ideology to the Office of Strategic Service for the war effort so they could understand both communism and fascism as they were playing out in Germany. The seeds for the CIA were laid in the OSS. Herbert Marcuse was a tightly working member of the OSS, and his objective, apart from maybe that work, I don't know, was certainly throughout the rest of his career to destroy America from within. I think Andrew Breitbart very famously positioned him as this grumpy German man who walks out into sunny Southern California, Santa Monica, looks around and hates everything. He's just pissed off that people are happy. And this is sort of a very real character of him. Now, what's interesting is he had access, working in the OSS, to intelligence that most people wouldn't have had. So therefore, kind of uniquely among Marxists in the West, he also knew what Mao Zedong was doing in China to a higher degree than most people would have been able to assess. And there are very strong reasons to believe that Marcuse's program, whether it's repressive tolerance, which is this very biased, tolerate the left but do not tolerate the right program that he wrote up in 1965, whether it's One Dimensional Man about the non-sustainability of capitalism, the view of the Essay on Liberation that he wrote in 1969, outlining that we have to create an entirely new identity politics engine for socialism in the West. There are reasons to believe that that was all borrowed from Mao, from his observations of Mao, and it was very little of it was original to him. That's not definitive. Nobody quite knows what went on behind those closed doors. Mm-hmm. But there is this connection there. And the seeds of the CIA, whatever it was doing, certainly incorporated an awful lot of Frankfurt School theory, at least to understand what was going on in Germany, but perhaps also adopting a great deal of that. Like we picked up the German schooling method, the Prussian model of education as well under socialists like John Dewey in the 1920s, because it was deemed to be very valuable and useful for ordering society. It's very likely that some of these things were picked up in the intelligence communities as well, understanding the dialectical methods, certainly color revolutions, which the CIA is known to be involved in around the world and more likely here as well now, are based off of dialectical manipulation.
There's a lot to unpack here. We've got about a minute before we have to take another break. And I just wanted to ask you, to the extent that Mao was the end of communism 2.0,
yes,
and what Marcuse and company were doing was taking his sort of basic ideas and translating them into 3.0. Is that how we find ourselves basically at this point?
Yeah, to be very brief before the break, the question was, how do you solve the problem of production? And the answer was that if you treat the communist state, so after Mao dies, Deng Xiaoping takes over, this is the same kind of thing that Marcuse is advocating for in 1964 in One Dimensional Man. If you want to solve the problem of production, what you have to do is take the socialist state almost like a universal corporation, and then other corporations operate in subsidiary fashion, like shell corps underneath.
Okay, this is a splendid point, which take a break. We'll be right back with more of how this plays out in our world and to what effect on you with Dr. James Lindsay. Stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. Dr. James A. Lindsay, the author of, among other things, The Marxification. I believe I've got that right.
That's right. Well,
I've lost my my notes on it. The Marxification of Education. James, you've set the stage brilliantly for what preceded our present moment in terms of this evolving communist threat. Let's talk a little bit about where you were just at that break. The solution to the problem of production and how that is now being implemented in a, well, you put the point rather bluntly, a color revolution here inside the United States.
Yeah, so I'll pick up with Marcuse very briefly. What he argues in the second chapter of One Dimensional Man, which is his magnum opus, which was a very influential book. If you've not heard of it, that doesn't matter. It was very influential in 1964, 5, and going forward. He argues in the second chapter that the problem with socialism is that it can't produce, and the problem with capitalism is that it produces unsustainably. And so all of a sudden, you see the seed for the buzzword of our century, which is sustainability. So what he posits is that the two have to be seen as two sides of the same problem. How do you produce but with the right ideology? How do you produce but sustainably? And what happened actually is that for whatever set of reasons, probably in large conjunction with Harvard and Henry Kissinger's voyages over to China when Mao died, Deng Xiaoping takes over. Deng Xiaoping inherits a country in ruins. It's impossible to state how badly Mao destroyed China's economy. So the goal is not to implement Maoism. Maoism that is happening in America now with the identity politics and the division and everything else that we see is just a wedge to open up the country. The economic model to install is the one that has succeeded in China since 1978 when Deng Xiaoping famously said I don't care if the cat is black or white as long as it catches mice. So the idea was that the CCP would operate as a super corporation and they would open up a market, a corporate market within China to allow people to try to get rich. This was actually importing the fascist model of Mussolini into the broad umbrella of socialism. And Deng even said that what he was doing was all for the glory of socialism and for the advancement of the CCP. So this model creates a Potemkin market inside of a communist totalitarian system. And if you play ball and you bring glory to the CCP and you solve the problem of production for them, you're doing great. But if you violate the party, you embarrass the party, you expose the party, you challenge the party, all of a sudden you're Jack Ma, you disappear, your fortune's gone, maybe you're in jail. It's not a good scene for you. So it's a Potemkin market underneath the power of the CCP. But China was the so this is the productive socialism side of Marcuse's vision in some sense. China was the beta test. Now they're trying to unroll this in our time through models like ESG in particular, through rather than having a communist structure on top, they're letting a corporate oligarchy sit on top, a literally fascist organization of public and private collusion. I don't even want to call it a public-private partnership as they do. It is public and private collusion. As Vivek Ramaswamy phrases it really, really well, what they cannot achieve through the front door of government, they achieve through the back door of the corporations. And that's exactly the model.
James, a book that we've recently published on this subject called The Indictment talks a lot about the corporatists who are aiding and abetting the Chinese Communist Party. They call them their old friends. This is an interesting phenomenon. They apparently don't really subscribe to communism, though they admire the model of its efficiency and even its ruthlessness, I guess. But they are enablers of this penetration and subversion, this unrestricted warfare, and seemingly are fine with the ultimate agenda, which is, I think you would agree, the takedown of the United States. Is that right?
You know, I mean, it all makes sense, really, from their perspective. If you think about it, they like the cheap slave labor that communism can provide for them, so they can get manufacturing done extremely cheaply. They have this kind of quasi-market in China that operates under the CCP, which becomes a humongous retail market for them, for companies like Nike, for example. Nike's the NBA. These corporations are bigger in China than they are. The market in China is far bigger than the Western market, the US market. So they can make a ton of money off of it. But at the end of the day, just like the Rockefellers funding Dewey's scam that I mentioned earlier, just like the Rockefellers funding who knows what other communism that we've all had to deal with, just like the Rockefellers being the ones behind the push for natural asset companies now, turns out really big industrialists don't like competition. When you get to the top of the mountain, you don't want to play king of the mountain anymore. You don't want to have to fight to stay on top of the mountain. So they engage in things like regulatory capture or kind of these sideways deals. It's all to their benefit to push socialism, which ends up making it impossible for other entities to rise up and compete with their market dominance. Mm-hmm. And so there's a weird logic there.
Are lashed up with the party that is controlling this.
That's right. And they benefit from that. They benefit directly from it, and they benefit in the long run from that by getting to be the new philosopher kings of the economic system, if you will, to kind of draw off of Plato's structure for that.
Do you think that they believe that they will benefit in the long run by actually being among the ruling elites when the United States is gone? I think history doesn't suggest that actually.
You would hope that they know history better than that. But what I suspect is that it's very cutthroat at the top. And the power struggles there are probably mostly hidden from view, but they're probably also vicious. I think some of that may have actually peeked through with Mark Zuckerberg, for example. Some of his behaviors in the last few years indicate that he may have been thinking it was time for him to claim a piece of his pie. And then he got told very, very clearly that he was not entitled to any pie yet. And so I suspect there are very strong power struggles there. Just like the CCP involvement, you know, you have Kissinger going and making deals with Deng Xiaoping. You have Klaus Schwab, who was Kissinger's disciple, by the way, at Harvard, going over in 1978, immediately trying to bring the World Economic Forum into China and bring Deng to the European Management Forum meeting that year. He didn't come, but they set up a meeting in China that's happened every year since. So immediately...
Where do they hold those meetings? Do they change the venues or is it always the same?
The main World Economic Forum meeting is held in Davos. I don't know where the Chinese meeting is held.
Yeah, I
forgot which city.
Figure that out, right?
I mean, there's a wonderful book. I recommend people look at it because it's kind of the tell-all where they brag about themselves, as these people like to do, where the World Economic Forum published a book that you can still find, to my knowledge, for free online if you Google it by its title, which is The World Economic Forum, The First 40 Years. And they brag about what they accomplished year after year after year with pictures, with full expose of themselves from 1971 to 2011. And it's a very eye-opening read to see their involvement. That's how I learned they got so involved with China.
Let me come back to sustainability, because you alluded to this a moment ago, but I really owe you a debt of gratitude in that you put me onto this whole gambit of ESG kind of on steroids, so-called natural asset companies. We've talked a little bit about it on the program, but give us kind of your assessment of what this is, how this fits into the larger agenda that you've just described so well.
Yeah, well, sustainability is the ultimate pretext for tyranny. Whether it's through public health, whether it's through identity politics and social dynamics, or whether it's through environmental claims, it becomes this pretext for the people who have deigned themselves stakeholders to say what is sustainable and what is not sustainable and organize the world around that.
And as I recall, you participated brilliantly in a really powerful webinar that we did with our Committee on the Present Danger China last week on this issue of natural asset companies. Did you ascribe to Karl Marx himself this insight that sustainability, whatever he called it, would be a vehicle for kind of the weaponization of his program?
Well, there is a book recently by a Japanese Marxist named Kohei Saito named Marx in the Anthropocene Toward an Idea of Degrowth Communism that very thoroughly matches up to the later writings of Marx in the third volume of Capital. A very strong environmental streak to avoid what Marx called metabolic rift, which is in short that human beings become out of step with nature. But in Marx's very early writings in the 1840s, well before 25 years before he wrote Capital, he was writing that nature is man's inorganic body and that we have to understand that everything that we have as human beings, he writes this also in the Critique of the Goethe Program, for example, is actually from nature. There is no productivity. There is no value that doesn't come from nature. And so nature is the ultimate repository of value. And then he believed that capitalism drags people out of being able to be in proper step with nature. So the entire sustainability movement really can be pinned back to Marx's theories, and not just his late ramblings in the third volume, unfinished volume of Capital, but even into his very earliest, most religious writings in the 1840s. And like I said, his Critique of the Goethe Program, which most people wouldn't know what that is today, but in essence, the modern version of that is the Green New Deal, is this eco-socialist green growth program. That's the Goethe program. And Marx is like, no, it's not communist enough. The Goethe program arose in Goethe in Germany, and it was a socialist program that Marx said didn't go nearly far enough. It didn't go anywhere close to as far as what a true communist should look like. It's a crude communism, not a true communism. And what we see in our day is, whether it's ESG or the natural asset company NAC movement, is we're seeing the same critique of the Green New Deal program. It just reproduces the Critique of the Goethe program. So this all boils back down to Marx and Marx's basic ideas about a true transcendent communism. As Marx phrased it, true communism is a positive, this is an exact quote, by the way, a positive transcendence of private property as human self-estrangement. So in this case, estrangement from nature. So ESG, sustainability, and natural asset companies are supposed to bring us back into harmony with nature and to unestrange us from nature.
Without private property.
Without private property.
This is the key piece. We'll be right back with more with James Lindsay explaining what all this natural asset company business means for you and our country. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. 3 years ago, America was fundamentally transformed, not by an insurrection, but by those who engineered a riot at the Capitol and what they've done to weaponize and exploit that event ever since. The few who engaged in actual crimes that day posed no credible threat of overthrowing the government of the United States, and many hundreds of patriotic American citizens peacefully demonstrating on the Hill have been prosecuted, jailed, bankrupted, and otherwise unconstitutionally subjected to cruel and unusual punishment, thanks in part to the suppression of exculpatory evidence of official decisions that facilitated their entry into the Capitol and provoked the crowd. At Valley Forge today, President Biden will continue his practice of vilifying not just them, but half the country who were also disenfranchised and have subsequently been relentlessly portrayed as enemies of democracy and potential violent extremists. Really? This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and Dr. James Lindsay is in the house with us virtually. He is the author, among other things, of The Marxification of Education. And we're going to talk about education now and the role that it is playing. We talked about the Frankfurt School, which began, I gather, with the help of the OSS during World War II as a means of injecting ideas and communist doctrine into our educational system. They've come a long way, baby, as it turns out. The march through the institutions, as it's been called, is now full on in academia, but unfortunately, I think every other institution as well. And we can talk before we're done, James, about the U.S. military as a prime example of that. But before we do, just give us a flavor of how all of what you've shared with us just now has been essentially synthesized, operationalized, weaponized, if you will, in the American educational system, government schools, as they're often called, as well as the private ones.
Yeah, that's right. In both, and our universities, very much in particular, have been kind of the seedbed for all of this. You are right to name the Long March Through the Institutions. That's a name given by the communist Rudi Deutschke. He, in 1966, laid that out to explain the infiltration of institutions laid forth by Antonio Gramsci originally in the birth of cultural Marxism, which is we're going to enter into those institutions and transform them from within. Gramsci, but also Deutschke, and then leading into Herbert Marcuse, as he wrote in Counter-Revolution and Revolt in 1972, all identified that education at all levels was the most important thing to take over. Because there's another, we talked about the problem of production that communists face. Well, there's another problem that was the problem of reproduction that they had to overcome. And that is that the schooling system and the cultural institutions reproduce society from one generation to another. If you raise your kids right and you educate your kids to participate as full members of society, turns out they reproduce the society that they lived in more or less. That's a big problem if you want a revolution. And so they had to overcome this. And so they immediately, after the radicalism of the 60s stopped working, and this is documented in their own literature, they immediately almost all turned to K through 12 education at the university level. They started to go into the university departments to build out fraudulent critical university departments like critical women's studies, critical race studies, ethnic studies, and so on. And they also started to take over schools of education, though it took them almost until 1990 to succeed in that endeavor. They imported a Brazilian model of radicalization that poses as education called critical pedagogy. It was developed by a Brazilian Marxist named Paulo Freire. It destroyed South American education. And then, yet again, through Harvard University, we imported it to the United States, again, primarily starting in the early 1990s. And the influence of this is unbelievably significant, but Paulo Freire, maybe significantly in his magnum opus called The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, wrote in a footnote in the first chapter that his model is based off of the model of education he saw used in Mao's China. So it is the Chinese model of brainwashing that Mao Zedong used in place of education in his revolutionary schools and colleges that has become the basis of the American education system. Now, why would they do this? Well, it's simple to say if you capture the education system, you capture the children, and then you capture the future. But if you actually read from, say, Klaus Schwab, who is the director of the World Economic Forum, he wrote a book in 22 called The Great Narrative for a Better Future. And he explains a three-piece plan that they've implemented, top-down, bottom-up, and inside-out. The top-down is you use things like NACs and ESG to coerce the corporations or incentivize the corporations to adopt the sustainability model. Then the bottom-up part is that you educate or miseducate or radicalize the students to believe that they can't live in a world that doesn't ascribe to this. This is your Greta Thunberg. She's running around saying the world's going to end in 5 years every other year and going back and deleting the tweets because she needs young people to believe they have no future so that the revolution becomes an existential fear for them. And they will demand these changes. They will protest. They will refuse to engage in commerce. They'll refuse to buy from a company that doesn't have this. This is what Klaus says is the point, and that they're transforming the youth through education models to do this. And the third is, he said that you, from the inside out, you rewrite the social contract. And that's also mostly accomplished through education and through corporate governance policy. And that's a kind of the mixture of both of these, so that we now have a social credit system locked in set of new beliefs and values that we all have to ascribe to because it's just the way it is. And that three-part plan is what Klaus Schwab lays out as the way to move forward into this new tyrannical future, which he describes as having greater central global cooperation and control to avoid crises like pandemics, to avoid crises like climate change, cyber warfare, and whatever else.
Mm-hmm. And this fear, whether it's fear, I think you said fear of the revolution, certainly fear of various things, pandemics and climate change and so on, is among the things being weaponized to enforce the discipline that the brainwashers have in mind. A friend of mine, Stan Ridgely, has written an interesting book on many of these subjects from the perspective of a university professor who is witnessing firsthand the indoctrination and the, particularly it seems the education school graduates' role in sort of enforcing all of this on campuses, not just at the university level, but below. He's written a book on the subject called Brutal Minds. And I have to say, it as someone who's not been in school or had kids in school for a long time, much of this was news to me. But I guess the good news, to the extent there is any, is what we have seen in terms of the knock-on effect of the lockdowns and the pandemics in terms of exposing parents to what their kids are being induced to believe. Talk a little bit about that. I know this is a central thesis of the Marxification of education. In fact, I'm going to ask you to hold the thought because when we get through the next 20 seconds, we're going to be at the end of it and I can't get you started and I have to stop so abruptly. But when we come back, we'll talk about what do we do about this, the role parents are playing now, and what we need to do about these NACs, among other things, to try to prevent the success of this Communism 3.0 enterprise. That and more with James Lindsay on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. We're back, and we've been, I think, benefiting enormously from the clarity of Dr. James A. Lindsay about what we are confronting, the people who seek to take down this country, and what they are well advanced in accomplishing in that regard, notably in our educational systems, but also now through other vehicles like ESG in the business sector, and now this new 2.0 version, I guess I'd call it, of ESG, these natural asset companies. So, James, in the fullness of a couple of minutes that we have left, give us some ideas as to what we need to be doing in the face of all of this.
Well, I mean, I think I'll just turn to Mr. Schwab. Klaus Schwab told us what they want to do, so in three parts. So it appears to me that we need to discombobulate his plans in three parts. So the first of those is the top-down part with the ESG and the NACs. Well, that needs to be exposed. It needs to be, we need to leverage our, what power we have, which would be congressional oversight committees, if the Financial Services Committee. We need to be leaving comments from the SEC. We need to be fighting this with lawsuits. We need to be getting, many states have actually fought ESG at the state level very effectively. That fight needs to continue and it needs to amplify, and we actually have to break the cartel logic that is creating this fascist subsidiarity model of corporate collusion that's stealing the American market from America. That's the first thing. We also are going to have to start withdrawing our dependence upon on CCP-controlled China for manufacturing and other things. But those two problems go hand in hand. So that's very legal. That's very working with congressmen, very filing lawsuits, getting state attorneys general and treasurers to stand up and do their part. What do normal people do? And of course, your audience, of course, has lots of ties to reaching to those power centers. But normal people need to protect their children. If the goal is to existentially terrify children so that they will revolt against their society, we have to bring our children back to Earth. The two primary ways that this is happening with our children, the schools are brainwashing centers, and that is a problem. We have to protect or deprogram our children from that, but it's working hand in hand with the children's entertainment industry, including on social media like Chinese-controlled TikTok. They are getting actually most of these ideas, and I've talked with many of the detransition young people who are coming out of the trans madness, and they've all told me the same story, that they started to get radicalized on social media, and then the schools confirmed it for them. So the schools are brainwashing, and in particular about these things gender and sexuality and race, but also about sustainability and climate change. But at the same time, this stuff is coming out of things like TikTok and Instagram, and our kids' access to social media is a question that parents are going to have to start asking hard questions about, limiting access, and maybe even looking at limiting access for young people without adopting a digital ID program at the same time, legally speaking. And the third is that they want to rewrite our social contract. So we say, no, we won't rewrite our social contract. Our social contract is the United States Constitution, and we're going to fight for individual liberty. We're going to fight for our right to private property, and it's securing by a government that's led with the consent of the governed. And we're going to have to start bending our governance, demanding our elected leaders defend the Constitution and do govern with the consent of their constituents. No more of this crony capitalism, no more of these revolving doors. All of that has to get exposed and cleaned up so they can't rewrite our contract. They can't manage us from the top down, and they can't steal our children from us into a youth revolt, which we see pouring out into the street almost every day. P.S. Who's paying for that? Somebody is. Kids don't go protest spontaneously. Somebody's organizing it. Somebody's paying for it. That needs exposure as well.
And the unlikely partners in perpetrating that seem to me to be the communists, Marxists, however you wish to describe them, on the one hand, but increasingly the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes, well,
creating a new cause celeb in the form of this Gaza campaign.
And the nucleus of that atom with those two electrons floating around it is the United Nations. So the United Nations is at the dead center. They created ESG. They're the ones that are, their Agenda 30 by 30 is at the heart of the NAC movement. Their sustainable development agenda is what ESG exists to service. The United Nations is at the dead center of this. So it is time, hopefully, if 2024 prevails with a new administration, to start asking some very hard questions about our involvement and funding for the United Nations going forward.
No, you're absolutely right. Which brings me, just in closing and very much in passing, to say one of the things that we don't want to be doing, you spoke of governance, is going down the road that the UN would have us engage in of global governance, whether it's under the UN's auspices directly or the World Health Organization. James, this is a subject to which I hope we can return with you in the very near future. In the meantime, thank you for this extraordinary, insightful, and very compelling laydown of what we're confronting. I want to thank you also for irritating the Southern Poverty Law Center as much as I have tried to do over the years. This is precisely why they are trying to silence people like us, is that we're breaking the code. Let me turn to a final takeaway on a related subject, and that is that what we are confronting, I think, at the moment, in terms of a United States Senate that is professing to be concerned about the border of the United States, which is a means of further undermining this country, quite clearly, is reforming amnesty and providing more efficient processing of people. This is kind of the design that the Biden administration seems to have in mind. Let's be clear. There is one thing, and one thing only, that the United States Senate should be preoccupied with at this moment, whether it's in the furtherance of trying to get more money for Ukraine, or whether it's to get the money that's certainly needed by Israel, or for any other purpose. It is to shut down the border, to seal the holes in the fence that Donald Trump put in place, largely but not entirely, and to enforce the laws of the land. That's the job. And anything else is, unfortunately, I'm afraid, a bait and switch. And United States senators who are going to try to perpetrate that on us must be told, no way. We're going to have more on all of that in further conversations coming in the days to come. I want to say thank you to you for being with us on this program, especially. I think that what Dr. James Lindsay has laid before us is an invaluable prism through which to understand the challenges of our time, which will be very much in evidence in this year, I fear. We'll be covering it as closely as we can, and with your help, we'll be doing what we can about it. I hope you will join us again next time for this edition, the coming editions of Securing America, and that in the meantime, you will go forth and multiply.